I'm Georgie Crawford. You're listening to the Good Glow podcast. Throughout my treatment for breast cancer, I've realised the importance of self-care. Whether that's a 5K run, a checkup with your GP, or even a 5-minute dip in the sea, the time has come for us to put ourselves higher on our own to-do list. This season, I've teamed up with Spotlight Oral Care. I know how important oral care is to our overall health and how we really need to look after our teeth and gums by using the best products. I've been using the Spotlight Oral Care Sonic Toothbrush and I love that it gives me that dentist clean feeling and is much more effective than a manual brush and less abrasive. Use the discount code GOODGLOW25 on spotlightoralcare.com to get 25% off the entire range. Why not pick up some perfect stocking fillers this Christmas and get them delivered straight to your front door? This week on the Good Glow podcast, I speak to Holly Ryan. Holly and I have gotten to know each other over the past year. Holly shared her story with me and feels ready now to share it further. When she was 18, Holly was attacked as she made her way home. She was so close to her house that she could see it, and her mum woke up to her screams. Thankfully, Holly's mum and dad and a passerby stopped the attack and Holly was taken home. Today, she takes me through the impact that night had on her life, how hard it was for her to share her story, and how she healed. I'm so grateful to Holly for sharing her story today. I know it wasn't easy for her, but she wants to use her voice to educate people. I often think about what sort of world our kids are growing up in, but when I see people like Holly Ryan, I feel so hopeful and thankful to have amazing people like her paving the way for the next generation. In the last couple of weeks, a plan has been published by the government for supporting victims' journeys through the reporting of sexual offence cases. For more information on this plan, you can see this episode's show notes. Holly, welcome to the Good Glow podcast.
Thanks for having me, Georgie. So happy to be here.
I have to say it's been a pleasure to get to know you this year. I think we first started connecting with each other maybe last summer. Then you came to the Good Glow Live in January and we went for a lovely coffee in Marley Park a couple of weeks ago. So thank you so much for trusting me with your story and coming on to the Good Glow today.
Well, thank you for creating such a safe space for people to come on and share their story. So I'm so happy to be here.
Thank you. That means so much to me. First of all, how do you feel today?
I feel good today, despite the current circumstances. I'm happy to be here and I feel confident to share my story with you.
Let's talk about before the attack, what your life was like, what you were doing, what was going on for you around that time.
So the attack happened in 2015. So I was 18 at the time. I had just started college and I just met a lovely boy, Andrew, who's still my boyfriend today, 5 years later. I'm a middle child, 3 daughters, my mum and dad. And yeah, I live a very normal life. I suppose I was just innocently having fun with my friends, going out, starting college, getting to know people.
So everything was going really good in your life. And I've met your mum. She's amazing. You're obviously very, very close to her. So you'd started college and you, like you said, you were going out with your friends, having fun. You met this gorgeous guy, Andrew. So life was pretty good and you were enjoying things. And tell us then, let's just go straight to the night that this happened to you. And the night that your life changed forever.
Yeah. So it was the middle of November. I was only in college a couple of weeks at this stage and it was one of my friends' birthdays. So we had the usual, you know, a pre-drinks and a party bus into town. And I actually had my first seminar in college the next morning at 9 a.m. So they counted for attendance. So not a chance was I missing that. So I made sure that I wanted to get myself home early.
What were you studying in college?
Social science. Yeah. So I made sure that I wanted to get myself home early. And I slipped off from town at about 11 o'clock, say. So I hadn't drank that much, just for context, but I hopped on the Lewis at Harcourt Street, and you know, town was buzzing. It was just a student night. I don't know, are they Mondays or Tuesdays or whatever they are? And sat down on the Lewis, and you know, after a couple of minutes, a man came and sat beside me. And you know yourself, when the Lewis isn't overly busy and someone sits beside you, you're not really up for having a chat or a conversation. I was just texting away on my phone. So this man, he just kind of keeps chatting away, and I just wasn't having it. I just wasn't in the mood. So I realised quite quickly that he was trying to, you know, flirt with me, I suppose, and whatever. So I actually moved seats. I moved from where he had sat down beside me, and he actually followed me and sat down beside me again. So at this stage, I suppose I was probably being a little bit naive, but I still wasn't having any of it.
And what sort of things was he saying to you?
Oh, I'm from Italy. Have you ever been there before? And, you know, like, I suppose you're pretty, or whatever he was saying. It was quite obvious that he was trying to have it on with me. So I remember I had a photo of myself and Andrew at our Debs as my wallpaper on my phone. And I turned it around to him and said, oh, this is my boyfriend now. You better be careful. You know, just so naive. So I just kept texting away on my phone. I was texting Andrew. Usually, you know, if one of us is out, the other will stay up until we're home. So that was what we were planning to do that evening. So my stop was coming up, and I stood up to get off, and so did he. So immediately I was, you know, my attention was spiked. I was in go mode. I thought this was a bit strange. So I decided to stay back at the Lewis stop on the platform. I realised he was walking in the direction that I would be walking home. So I hung back. I watched him tag off with a leap card, and he proceeded to walk up the road in the direction where I live. So you can see my house from the Lewis stop. Like, when I tell you, I live 150 metres from it. It's so close. And it's a well-lit road. It's a busy road, you know. And I watched this guy, and I watched him disappear into an estate just before my own estate. So after a couple of minutes, I decided I'd start to walk up the road. And I started to call Andrew. And the phone was ringing out, and God, I knew he was asleep, and I was there just waking him up for a chat for my 1 minute walk home. So I decided to stay on the opposite side of the road to the route that I'd usually take home, because that would be a bit more well lit, I suppose. And I didn't want this guy to see where I lived or anything. So as I was walking up the road, phone to my ear, I had a look in down the into the estate that he had gone into to see if he was kind of lurking around or anything, and there was no sign of anyone. So this is probably around 11:30, I suppose, at this stage, and it's a really windy night, you know, November. And up where I live, like, it's at the foot of the mountains, the wind is always worse up there. So I had a look in, no sign of him. I have my phone to my ear. I'm walking up the road, about to turn to cross the road into my estate. And I turn to look up and down, and this man is running at me. Like, I didn't even have... I'd say he took two leaps from when I first saw him to when he got to me. And he just took me clean out. He knocked me straight to the ground. I remember my phone went flying, my bag went flying. And so at this stage then, he's completely on top of me, and his weight is holding me down. He's on my body, and I'm flat on my back on the ground, and both of his hands are holding my arms down. So I naturally screamed, you know, and I'm screaming and screaming and, you know, I don't necessarily remember screaming now. I do know that I said, please get off me. Don't know why I decided to use my manners in such a time like that. But then he actually put his mouth over my mouth to stop me from screaming. And that was when I knew, like, this guy is really, really, really evil. Like, this could go anyway, you know? So at this point, I'm on the ground and a car pulls up right beside us. And, you know, where this is all happening is about 50 meters from my house. Like, I can see my house. I was so close to home. And a car pulls up. And it was that moment that I just thought, this is Buddy. Like, you are... I just remember sort of seizing and going, you know, prepare for the worst now. This, you know, you're going to be bundled into the back of that car. Every second counts, you know.
Oh, my God.
And as the car was there, he actually started to try to undo my belt and my jeans. And I'm going, this is his friend. Like, this is two men. How are you going to, you know? And my phone, as I said, had been calling Andrew. And I knew that it had probably gone to voicemail or else he was on the other end of the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember as I was screaming, thinking, this is going to be used as evidence in, like, your trial of your death. Like, I didn't know what was going to happen, you know. But
all of these things are going through your mind.
It's like when time moves in slow motion.
Yeah.
And you just... I can't remember even having the full thought. You know, it just sprung to mind. And I remember everything did happen fast in reality. But, you know, for me, it felt like maybe a half an hour or 10 minutes or whatever. So anyway, the car is still there and nothing's happening. And your man is still, you know, like... Anyway, and... then the car beeps and the guy gets up and runs and someone gets out of the car and it's this man and he's going, I'm so sorry. I thought that it was two lads fighting. Are you okay? And in that moment, my mom and my dad were running across the road to me. My dad in his boxers and his bare feet and my mom in, like, her PJs. And, like, she's hysterical. And my mom, to this day, I do not know how this happened, but my mom somehow woke up from me screaming. I've no idea. Like, between the wind and everything, I don't know how she heard. She just says she shot up and she just knew that I was in trouble. And she ran out to the window, saw that my bag was quite far away from, you know, me being on the ground and this guy being on top of me, and realized straight away. And I think she just ran down the stairs screaming, and my dad obviously woke up too. And my dad just said, what way did he go? And I just pointed into that estate and my dad just ran like hell for leather.
Oh my God.
Well, he never found him. So, spoiler alert. But yeah, I mean, I don't know what could have been going through his mind at that time, you know? Like, to just run and not even know what you're looking for, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I can't, like, as a mother of a daughter... it's my absolute worst nightmare.
Yeah. And, you know, almost selfishly, I'm glad that it happened to me, because I don't know how I could deal if that happened to my mom or one of my sisters.
Mm. I know exactly what you mean, you know, when you say that.
Yeah. So then I went back to my house and the guy, Adam, who'd been driving the car, he was just an innocent lad driving by. He said, "I'll wait with you." He actually called the guards for us. And he said, "I'll wait with you until they come. I saw what happened. You know, I'll give a statement or whatever." So the guards came. They met us at my house. And they maybe took his details. I'm not so sure. He definitely spoke to them. And they handed me a bag. And they said, "You need to give us all of your clothes, your jewellery, everything that you're wearing, your underwear, your socks, everything." So obviously it had to be used for evidence. So I came back down the stairs and my mum and my dad were there making the two Gardaí a cup of tea. It's a very Irish scene. When I think back on it, I think that my adrenaline kicked in at this stage. And I remember being afraid to go to sleep in case I forgot anything. And I was trying to explain to them. And then this happened, and then this happened. And I was trying to get it all out in that moment. So, you know, I was so naive. I thought, you know, if I just verbalize it to a guard, that's it and it's done and whatever. Mm-hmm. And now, they were lovely. They really, really were. And they really cared that, you know, for my safety, and they cared that I was okay. But in that moment, one of them turned to my dad in front of me while I'm sitting there and goes, "Would you say she's had a bit to drink tonight now?" And I lost it, Georgie. There was CCTV footage. They'd just spoken to an eyewitness, and I had a recording on my phone because it had left a voicemail for Andrew. And he's there asking, "Have I had a bit to drink?" And I understand that actually it is a relevant question in a case or a trial, but you know, it definitely wasn't the time, and it definitely, I was so alert. I was trying to convey the entire story before forgetting anything. And that just takes the wind out of you. And that's where the self-doubt then starts to seep in.
Mm.
You know,
it's planting the seed almost.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, the poor guard regretted the words that came out of his mouth straight away. I mean, he didn't mean it in the way that it came out.
Mm-hmm.
But I just felt insanely disrespected and doubted. And I lost it, you know, and I'd do it again. But so the next morning when I woke up, I think I was just, I felt as though I just escaped death. I just had a brush with death, you know, and yeah. I was just in this mode of, I'm fine. I'm absolutely fine. I'm awake. I'm breathing. My heart is beating. I'm absolutely fine. And my mom took me first thing to give my statement. I had to give my official statement down in the Garda station. And so we went in, and my mom came in with me to give my statement. And when I think back now, it was probably a mistake that she came in, because between trying to convince myself that I was okay and trying to convince my mom that I was okay, the guards that were taking my statement, they saw right through it. And they said, you know, don't hold back. Are you afraid of upsetting us? We've seen it all. We won't be bothered by any of this. You can tell us anything, you know, you just, you know, do your best, and offering me tea and water and everything. And they were so lovely. And then they said, "Will we take your mom out for a minute? Do you want to talk to us alone?" And I'm gone. I'm fine. I'm absolutely fine. Look at me. I'm here. I'm fine. And I told them the story the same way that I told the night before. But then there was a question of, and can you tell us what you were wearing? So they said to me, look, it's for CCTV purposes. So that was fine. So I explained I was wearing a coat. I was wearing jeans. I was wearing over-the-knee boots. And he stopped me. And he just said, look, this is absolutely no judgment on our part. And it wasn't. I knew it sincerely wasn't. But he said, if I write over-the-knee boots, this actually could work against you in a trial. So, like, we have this system where, like, our guards are trying to protect us from the criminal justice system, you know? Mm-hmm. So that took me back. I didn't really care. They had my boots anyway, and I was never going to wear them again. But, you know, like, it's just... the process of the whole thing is that the guards take all of the evidence... and they put together a file of evidence and then they send it on to the director of public prosecution, mm-hmm. who decide whether there's substantial evidence that a crime occurred and that it's, like, I suppose, worthy of a trial, mm-hmm. and a case. So then...
Did Andrew answer the phone that night?
So Andrew didn't answer the phone. And it left a voice message on his phone, or a voicemail. And it was a recording of the whole thing.
And did you get to Andrew before he listened to that and tell him what happened?
Yes, so I did. He has never listened to it. He actually got his brother to record it and send it on to the guards as evidence for the case. But yeah, no, he never listened to it, thank God. So then after I gave my statement, I was just craving any sense of just normality. I just really wanted to pretend that this never happened. I was embarrassed by the intention of the whole thing, you know. And my mom was like, come on, we'll get you home, you know. Let's relax. And I was going, Mom, don't you need to do your shopping? Like, let's go. Let's go to Lidl or Aldi or wherever it was. I mean, I was in another world. I don't know.
Do you think, looking back, that's denial? Or were you just trying to move on really, really quickly?
I think I was trying to move on. I think I was trying to protect my family, you know? And I think, like, when I think back on it, I wanted to give my statements the same as the night before so quickly. I wanted to get it out while I could remember it all. And I think actually, like, the darker times came the following couple of weeks when I was, you know, sharing my story with people, and that brought on a whole other amount of problems. Like, people cared and they were asking for me because they cared, but, like...
And did you go back to college, or did you kind of disappear for a while? Did you, you know, have to pick up the phone and tell your friends, or...?
So I remember the next morning sending a couple of texts out and voice messages to tell people. And then I did not go out again for a long time, like a really long time. And, you know, it was really at the start of when you're in college and you're supposed to be, you know, making friends, and you're supposed to go to every night out that you're invited to, you know, because you want to meet new people. But I found that the reactions that I got from people, it was clear that they actually were not ready to hear these kind of stories. Like, some of the questions that I was asked, I would say most people that I told asked me how much I drank. And, like, these are friends and peers, you know. And, you know, it's important to not forget that I was 18. So the people that I was talking to were also 18. Mm. And not that it matters, but what were you wearing? It's just, these questions are so damaging to like any sort of culture of trust and understanding.
How did they make you feel?
I suppose I lost all confidence in the story that I was so sure of, you know, and
yeah.
I had, it definitely felt as though the story turned into a point of gossip for some people. I had friends' moms say things like, well, what were you doing out at that time anyway? Well, what was I doing out at 11:30 on the road back to my house? Like, I'd expect to be able to walk up that road in my underwear and high heels at 4 a.m. and be okay, you know? Like, and people, I think, didn't realise that, how damaging that is to the, it can really discourage people from reporting. I'm so, so thankful that my mom took me straight away to go and give my statement, because honestly, Georgie, I don't know if I would have given it after having spoken to people. Like, the victim shaming and trying, it felt like people were trying to calculate, well, how much of this are you to blame for though? Were you really drunk? Could you have been targeted easily? Or what was your choice of clothing? It's just this victim shaming culture. It's just poisonous.
Mm.
So about 3 weeks later, I suppose, I got a phone call from the guards, and they'd been brilliant at keeping me up to date on any updates that they'd come across or anything like that. Like, honestly, they were so helpful and so lovely, and just, they really, they genuinely cared.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel confident that they would get to the bottom of it?
I didn't, because I knew that, you know, for the most part, these things, they, you know, someone like that usually just gets away. And, you know, it's like when someone breaks into your house or robs your car, like, it's so rare that they mm-hmm. actually find the person. But with this situation, the guy had tagged off with a Leap card. And that was like really the key for them in the end. So I got this phone call from one of the lads down there. And every phone call, they'd ask me how I was getting on. Was I okay? And did I need to talk to anyone? Like, they were just brilliant. And he said to me, look, Holly, we've good news and we've bad news. So the good news is that we found him and we arrested him. But the bad news is that he's only 17. So given
were you,
that...
How did you feel when they said that to you?
I still didn't really understand.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot to like take in.
Yeah, I didn't understand. I thought, you know, well, we have him. Like, yeah, happy days. Yeah. We have him, you know, sorted. And he said, look, as I said before, so the guards, like, that case is essentially out of their hands. Once they've gathered all that information, it's up to the DPP to decide what happens.
Mm.
And he said to me, look, you know, you're not going to get anywhere with this now. And I could tell that they were so disappointed. Like, they had put so many resources into trying to find this guy. Like, you know, they eventually found him, and they were so upset for me. They were devastated for me. I suppose they just see so many of these cases just go, you know, unfinished. People get away with horrible things. So yeah, like the following weeks after that, like, it was really dark. It was, you know, and it was Christmas, so I was able to kind of be distracted, I suppose, but I was definitely in a bad place.
And did they give you any information about him, like where he was or
so,
why was he here? Or
so they told me that he was an Italian student studying English in Dublin. And he actually was living with a family in the estate just behind where I lived. And they had young children. So, I mean, they lost it when they heard what had happened. I know that they weren't able to tell me his name. They weren't able to tell me much about him. But they told me that he got given this thing called a J-Lo. Now, we used to call it a J-Lo when I was younger, but essentially what it is that you have been appointed a juvenile liaison officer. So they kind of, they're a guard within the area.
Okay.
And I suppose they check in on you to make sure that you're not up to no good. But like, I have multiple friends who got given or assigned a J-Lo when they were like 15 and 16 drinking in fields. So I knew what this was. So actually it felt like more of a sting that that's what he was given.
Mm.
Essentially, it's just a warning. I remember saying to the guard, like, if he goes on and attacks someone again, is this going to come up? No. No, it's not going to come up. And I know he did say, I remember the guard telling me that the guys, now he looked mid-20s to me. Like, I couldn't believe that he was 17. I was shocked to hear that he was 17, because if you told me he was 25, I would have believed you, you know? I think that the family who were hosting him completely kicked him out. And I think because they were working on the case in the guard station, they didn't want him to leave the country and go back to Italy.
Mm.
So I know that his parents came over.
Okay.
That's all I know. I was given the option of meeting him for an apology. But I mean, I didn't want to give him or his family that peace or that, you know,
closure.
Yeah. I didn't want that, you know. And in recent years, I've kind of thought, I wish I went and I wish I said this and I wish I said that. But to be honest, I don't remember his face anymore. Mm. And that's fine by me.
Mm. Yeah. So would you say then you were slowly trying to rebuild, or what happened next?
My circle became very small after that. You know, I had my people. Mm. And they were people that saw things the same way that I saw them and would always have my back. Yeah. You know,
how was your dad, by the way?
He was fine. I mean, my dad is great at, you know, trying to create that, you know, normality, and trying to create like a comfortable normality where you can just get back into it. And, you know, he's my poor dad. Like, we give him such a hard time. He says, I have 3 daughters and 4 wives, because we just don't give him a break. But he was great. I remember I had times where I'd have bad dreams, or I'd be constantly locking the doors in the house. I'd be constantly locking the back door and everyone would be getting locked out in my house. And him going, okay, we're going to try it where we don't lock the door for a week and stuff like this. So he was brilliant. Like, they were great, you know. And Andrew was just my entire strength. Like, I have to credit him for any strength that I've had in dealing with this situation or channeling my energy into something else. Like, when I told him about coming onto this podcast today, I said to him, you know, are you okay with it? Like, I could be talking about you and your friends might listen to it, and would you be embarrassed? And he just said, Holly, I'd be so proud of you.
Oh my God, that's like crying. That's so lovely.
Yeah.
It must have been so hard for him to see you like so hurt.
I mean, the poor guy, like, we'd been going out only a couple of weeks, so I don't know. He was just amazing, and he still is, you know, and he's never shied away from talking about it with me, whereas with my family, I'd be so worried about upsetting them. They would only be worried about me, but, you know, it's been great to have an independent person to talk to as well, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So you continued on with college, did you?
So I continued on with college. I was not letting this hold me back. Like, absolutely no way. I wasn't going to repeat a year or, you know, have to repeat classes or anything like that. And I just went for it, hell for leather. Although I definitely wasn't having the experience that I should have been having. I wasn't going out that often, and if I did, I just wasn't enjoying it. I was far too on edge, you know. So, you know, over the coming years, then I decided to channel my energy into things like Repeal the Eighth, and that's something that I'll always be so proud to have been involved in. And then there was a campaign for consent in my university, and it was about educating other students on the definitions of consent. So I took part in that as well, and that was brilliant. But ultimately, it was kind of like dealing with the situation, but not dealing with it. Dealing with it for other people. Mm. And it still was very triggering, but I was in complete denial. I couldn't see the reason in why should I have to pay, or my mum and dad have to pay for counselling for me for something that someone else did. Like, I'm not letting that hold me back anymore. Not a chance. You know, I wasn't being practical about it. So then I finished college, and, you know, things did pick up around kind of second year, third year. I got in with an amazing group who I'm still friends with today. Spent a summer abroad in Vancouver, and, you know, I did start to have that real kind of student life again, and that was brilliant. So we finished up in college, and myself and Andrew decided that we were going to do a J1 visa to New York for a year, just the two of us. We were terrified. He always says he didn't know what he talked to me about for a year. So we did find plenty of things to talk about. That was fine. But I think New York was just an incredible realization for me that I wasn't done. I wasn't over this. I hadn't dealt with it all. There was, as we've all seen in recent months, just so many terrible injustices in America. And New York is really the heart of those kind of injustices.
Mm. And how quickly did you figure out that New York wasn't maybe what you thought? Was it not what you thought it was going to be, or did it just affect you differently? Or
I think it affected me differently. I'd been there before on trips, you know, just for a couple of days, a long weekend. And, you know, you see the magic of it then. But the magic wears off when you're getting the subway every day, and you see these people who are living in this incredible poverty, and you experience racism, and you see people being discriminated against. Like, I've always been someone who just cannot handle injustices, but America's a different ballgame. Like, you can't speak up in America. If someone says something really rude to you, you have to keep walking because it's dangerous. You know, New York is dangerous. And not being able to stand up for myself was something that just brought up so much for me. Mm.
I'll get back to that conversation in just a minute, but first, I wanted to give you an update on my Sonic toothbrush. Great teeth start with Spotlight Oral Care's Sonic toothbrush, the oral care staple. Designed with both efficiency and comfort in mind, it ensures an amazing clean, as it is gentle and effective in removing plaque and discoloration, even for sensitive teeth. The 2-minute timer and high frequency brush movement, along with 3 speed settings for personalized cleaning, sensitive, clean, and white, will improve your long-term oral health. With a travel case and personalization options available, it's the ideal gift for you or a loved one this Christmas. Check out spotlightoralcare.com for more. Now, back to my conversation.
You know. And how old were you?
21, turning 22.
Right, God, you were so young.
Yeah. So that was really tough. And, you know, just small things like the poverty and the racism. And I was ready to come home then by the end of that, you know. I was really ready to come home.
But you stuck it out for the year.
I stuck it out. I actually started listening to The Good Glow going on the subway into work, and I'd be bawling my eyes out. But I got into a master's just before we left, and we were definitely ready to go home. So when we got back to Dublin, was, you know, I'm still so happy to be home. But when we got back to Dublin, I started my master's and, you know, I was obviously incredibly busy, but it kind of hit me like a ton of bricks. I had so much imposter syndrome and I was being really hostile towards my dad. Like anything he'd say, I'd be like, oh, what do you mean by that? You know, what about women and all this? And, you know, he might have meant nothing by it. So I decided to see the counsellor that was available to me through college. Now, over, you know, this was 4 years later. And throughout those 4 years, I was having dreams 2 and 3 nights a week of someone coming to get me. And I'm opening my mouth and nothing's coming out to scream like help or anything like that. Or I'm trying to run and my legs won't move. And I knew that this was obviously something that was trying to come into my conscious mind, and I just was ignoring it.
And would you tell anybody about those dreams?
Yeah, I would, but I don't know if anyone kind of thought too much into it in that sense. I knew.
Mm-hmm.
I knew deep down, I did know. So my first day going in to visit the counsellor, I had kind of not even planned to talk about the attack. I was thinking, like, why do I feel like I'm not worth being in this course? And that's what I'm going to talk about. And I'm going to talk about how mean I'm being to my dad. And 10 minutes into it, I'm bawling my eyes out. I've told him the whole story about the attack. And he said to me, Holly, you have PTSD. And I just didn't think that I was a person who could have gotten PTSD, you know, like not a chance.
So you were shocked then when they when he said that.
But it felt like everything actually made sense then. Mm. You know, it felt like everything sort of fell into place when he said that. And so he diagnosed me with PTSD and he said that he wanted to do this cognitive behavioral therapy with me that would bring the event out of my unconscious mind into my conscious mind, because actually to bring it forward would allow me to forget it and process it easier.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a couple of things that he wanted me to do. You know, he wanted me to listen to that recording and I'd never listened to it before. He wanted me to go through every detail with him. And I really went through it then. That was January of this year. And I went through what I should have gone through, you know, 4.5 years prior.
And what was it like to listen to the voice recording?
I had convinced myself over that time that I didn't scream. I don't know why. I didn't understand how my mom had heard me. I thought it may have just been a faint sort of noise that she heard, but I had convinced myself that I didn't do enough to protect myself and that I didn't do enough in the moment, you know? And I think that was the hardest part of this whole thing was, you know, to realize that you're actually not invincible. You know, when you're a teenager, you think, like, I could be hit by a bus tomorrow and I'll still walk away fine, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That was really, really tough. And, you know, I suppose I just had to surrender to it. I'd been avoiding it for so long. I had to just give in and allow it to take motion and work. And it did. I'm in a far better place now, you know?
It's such an important point. And when I went to counselling and I would have fears of my cancer coming back and dying, like my counsellor would say, and what are you doing, you know, when you're having those thoughts? And I said, well, I literally physically punch them away. I pretend like I'm punching them away. And she was like, you have to let them pass through. You have to acknowledge it. You have to accept that you feel like that sometimes in order to deal with it, in order to process it. And that really opened my eyes. I never would have gotten to that place if I didn't go to counselling. And it really changed how I deal with things. And it sounds like that happened for you too.
Yeah, and I think it's hard because when you go through a hardship like that, like your illness, you don't want to admit. It feels almost like you're admitting a defeat to it, and mm-hmm. you don't want to do that. You know that you are a strong person, you know, you are such a strong person. And, you know, I consider myself to be a strong person. And I think it's hard because you need to be strong for so many other people and for yourself, you know, and it's absolutely not a form of weakness to go to counselling. It's not. It's actually a strength, you know, to admit that you need that help. You need that extra push. You need that extra ear, that extra support. You know, it's just so important.
And do you think that the 4 years, is that the time you needed to get to that point? Or is there a part of you that almost wished you went sooner?
I actually did go to one counsellor sooner, but we definitely did not gel. Mm-hmm. I went to him through the university that I was in, and I am such an open person. I'm such an open book, and I would be there talking my brains out, and he would reply, "And how did that make you feel?" And I'm going, "I just bloody told you how that made me feel. Like, I'm not a robot, you know?" Mm-hmm. And I think there's actually so many forms of counselling that people don't really understand. You know, sometimes you actually have to do a lot of research and relate your trauma to a certain type of counselling. And that might be the best route for you, you know, whereas that for me, it wasn't good. And that was part of why I just kind of said, no, I'm not going again. Counselling is absolutely not for me. I gave it such a blanket, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. Throwaway that I just wasn't having it.
So you're doing your master's in January of this year. You started counselling.
Yeah.
What has happened in 2020 for you?
So 2020 has been a very busy year. So I started my master's, which was in public affairs. And as part of that master's, I actually was fortunate enough to intern for two very, very special people in Dáil Éireann. And I suppose by being in Dáil Éireann and just kind of experiencing that atmosphere and the work that people put into every type of policy that's in place, and the work that these people put into working on behalf of their constituencies and stuff like that, like, it's such a thankless job, you know, to see on the other end the work that people put through for policies like sexual offences and stuff like that. It's years of work. It's years of difficult conversations. And it really opened me up to, I suppose, a more hopeful stance on the whole issue of the criminal justice system. And I learned so much. Like, my case was dealt with under the Criminal Law Sexual Offences Act of 2006. But when you think back, so it was 2015, when you think back to how much has happened since 2006, we are such a progressive country in comparison. So that was obviously such an outdated law to be dealing with. So that was actually amended to become the Criminal Law Sexual Offences Act 2017. So this was huge because it actually included a legal definition on consent. So the law now states that a person consents to a sexual act if he or she freely and voluntarily agrees to engage in that act. So it also provides several circumstances under which consent cannot be given. So that includes, you know, being asleep or unconscious or under force or the threat of force or being impaired by alcohol or drugs. You know, so these were the sort of things that I was learning, and, you know, to learn that there's people there that have your back and people are in there that want to make these situations better for victims of sexual offences. You know, like, I learned that, you know, groping someone in a nightclub, like, that's sexual assault. Like, that's a criminal offence. And I think that in Ireland, we're just, you know, we're brilliant at downplaying everything. You know, if that happens to one of your friends, people can often be like, "Ah, sure, he was just having a laugh. Don't mind him. Like, don't mind him. Don't let him ruin your night." Or the girl who does actually take issue with it and maybe tells the bouncer or whatever, it's, oh yeah, she's quite the feminist. I mean, that's not feminism. That's just a human looking for their personal space to not be invaded. I think people don't realise how damaging these sort of reactions to, you know, someone's story or someone's attack, they don't realise how damaging that is to the reporting process. And like, it really discourages people from reporting. It's poisonous behaviour. You should never, you know, hold back on your own morals for the sake of other people. And I think that's really taught me over the years who my friends are.
Mm-hmm. So obviously your time in New York opened your eyes to so much. But did that make you look to Ireland in a different way when you're comparing it to like living in America?
I suppose I appreciated Ireland so much more for what it has to offer and how far we've come. As I said before, I was quite heavily involved in the repeal of the 8th, and I, you know, voting that day, I think it was what, the 25th of May 2018, I honestly, like, that was the proudest day of my life. I went with my mom up to Kiltearnan to cast her vote, and like, I was crying at the ballot box. Like, I'll never forget it. Like, I don't think that I'll ever be so proud of a moment. I don't think that anything can top that, to be involved in, you know, improving women's health in Ireland. It's just huge. That, along with the same-sex marriage referendum, that was the first time I ever got to cast a vote. I had just turned 18. It's just such a special referendum, and I suppose it made me all the more proud to be Irish.
Mm. And are we continuing, from the way you look at things, do you think that we're continuing in the right direction?
Absolutely. There was a review that was recently conducted on the prosecutions for vulnerable witnesses in the investigation and prosecution of sexual offences. So this review included multiple recommendations, and, you know, they all take a victim-centred approach. So the issues to be considered as part of the implementation plan, which is going to be brought before the government in the next couple of weeks, please God, they're, you know, to ensure that preliminary hearings are provided to avoid delays in sexual offence cases. So that was a big issue, in that, you know, people would report their case, give their statement to the guards, and it could be months or years before they'd have to be thrown back into it. And, you know, there's a term that's come about recently, and it's re-traumatising. You know, to do something like this, to re-enter a trial maybe a year, 2 years after the event took place, it's re-traumatising for the victim. So on top of that, the implementation plan also seeks to ensure the development of a specialist training programme for serving members of An Garda Síochána Cána and legal professionals and others who are participating in a professional capacity in sexual offence investigations and trials. So, you know, ultimately, this entire review and plan aims to improve the confidence of victims in the criminal justice system as a means of increasing the reporting of sexual offences, because we just have such an issue with underreporting in Ireland, and it's really allowing the continuation of such crimes that we aren't taking a stance against it, and that, you know, our criminal justice system isn't acting as a protection for victims and rather is actually scaring them away.
Holly, you are such an incredible person. I've learned so much from you. I'm sure my listeners have too. But I just think you're such a special person. I think you're going to go on. You're going to take on the world. I'm so inspired by you. And It's been such an honor to get to know you over the last while. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Pressure's on now. So.
Is there anything else you want to add?
No, that was brilliant. Thank you so much for having me. I'm absolutely honored to be a part of the Good Glow team now.
Oh, you absolutely are. And I will obviously we'll stay in touch, but I'll be really looking forward to seeing what you do next.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
For listening to the Good Glow podcast with thanks to Spotlight Oral Care. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to my podcast and leave a review. It would really mean a lot. And if you want to learn more about my story, you can follow me on Instagram at georgie.crawford or head over to my website, thegoodglow.ie.